what quality of music are you going to get? When people have to work day jobs, you know, the whole phenomenon of being poor and famous.
You know, I don't know if that's going to work.
Our sister Natalie, someone asked her, what's your perfect day? And she says, I would wake up in London, I would go to Borough Market, and I would play at Royal Albert Hall that night. And then, seriously, two days later, James Bay texts us and is like, what do you think about this? And we're like, holy crap.
Because you're altering the DNA of everything you've been listening to, altering it, bringing it up to date, modifying it, and turning it into a kind of higher art form.
That trips me out more than any accolade, than winning any Grammy, than any of that shit. That's how you win.
I think I just really completely unhooked myself from the sort of rat race that you can get caught in with music. So I just was like, why would I do this unless I do exactly what I want?
I was nowhere. You know, I'd lost my record deal, massively in debt, and no obvious signs that I would ever be able to recover that, you know, because the career looked to be pretty much finished.
There is no formula to having a hit record. It happens, and it's probably 60% luck, 30% talent, and 10% timing.
Making a hit record is tough, but maintaining success is another skill entirely. On The Art of Longevity, we explore the artist's experience of the music business from the inside. I want to find out what separates those artists and bands that have survived decades in the music business from all those who've fallen by the wayside. We follow a narrative inspired by a quote from Brett Anderson of Suede, who said that all successful artists have followed a similar career arc, like stations of the cross. The struggle, success, excess, disintegration, and if you're lucky, enlightenment. With insights and stories for music fans, aspiring musicians, and creators, this is The Art of Longevity. The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand. Ed Harcourt, welcome to The Art of Longevity.
Thanks for having me.
How are you, Ed, and where are you? It looks very cozy where you are.
I'm in our old sort of, we live in an old 19th century cottage, no, 18th century, in South Oxfordshire. So we moved here about 6.5 years ago. I've just made a fire in the old Rayburn. It gets pretty cold, this house, so we don't have any mains gas, so I had to go and get like Calor gas. And the Calor gas place in Oxford, it seems to have shut down, so I have to go in the car. And then I have to kind of buy the massive 47 kilo, and then I have to roll them around the back side of the house, connect the pipes, and then we have gas.
All the time, hoping you don't blow yourself up.
Yeah. And usually, you know, when it's raining, I'm sort of rolling it, and I'm mumbling to myself, saying, move to the country, they said, you know. You know, you take it for granted when you live in the city, you know, with gas and just energy, you know, you just completely...
Yeah.
But to be honest, it was the best thing that we did. And I was in London for about 17 years, so kind of needed to get out.
And conducive for songwriting and creativity, presumably. Is your studio down there as well?
I mean, I think it is very conducive. I think one can write whatever environment you're in, I think. But I have always believed that isolation can be a very sort of, and I don't mean in the kind of the cliched Bon Iver out in the woods sort of isolation. I just mean you do need to have some kind of loneliness in order to kind of really dig deep, I think.
Speaking of isolation, before we get into the thick of it, as it were, I just want to say your two instrumental albums that you made in 2018, 2020, which bridged the pandemic, Beyond the End and Monochrome to Color, they basically helped get me through the pandemic.
Oh, wow. Thank you. That means a lot. Thank you.
I mean, they were beautiful records. In fact, my youngest daughter is currently, she's still listening to them now when she's revising her GCSEs.
Oh, that's great. I had a couple of people say, you know, I'm writing my book or I'm doing a dissertation or I've got a thesis and I've got the record on and it's really like helping. I'm just like immersed in it, but it's background music, but it's just kind of, I mean, and definitely Beyond the End is the more sort of meditative one. And that was made from a place of sort of well, I guess licking your wounds a little bit. I had a bit of a disaster with the album before that. So it's kind of like, I think, you know, it's a reflection of the definitely sort of where my mind was at the time, which was, I don't think I was even aware of it, but I think I was a bit sort of probably in a deep depression, you know, didn't even realize it, you know, I wasn't able to be objective, you know. So it kind of came from that because I wasn't able to write like any words at all. And the timing of that record was perfect because Rich Machin from Soul Savers literally called me up and said, do you want to do an instrumental record? And I'd only just built the studio and I'd driven all the way down to Plymouth to check out this Baby Grand that I saw on Gumtree. And it was the same make as the Baby Grand that I learned to play on, which was my grandmother's. So the Hopkinson. And I really wanted one that was similar to the piano that I'd kind of done Maplewood on and in this new studio. So I went down and this woman was, it was quite sad really. She was getting divorced and getting rid of the piano and she was selling it for about 500 quid, you know, which was insane. Wow. But it cost me 585 quid to move. And then sort of, you know, moved it to the studio and I had nothing to say, like lyrically. I just didn't know what to say because I'd done this massive, dark, heavy record. And so the timing of it was very kind of serendipitous. And I was literally starting to write, kind of, listening to stuff that I'd played when I was younger, like Satie and Debussy. But I was also heavily into Max Richter and the Nick Cave, Warren Ellis instrumental soundtrack stuff.
Yeah, okay.
I was kind of like listening to that and then, you know, and then, yeah, it just kind of just fell into place. So.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, you know, because it kind of put you in the neoclassical sphere, those two records. And I wondered how deliberate a move that was, but it sounds like more it was just came out of circumstances and that's where you found
it. It was circumstances, definitely. And it wasn't like a clever kind of career ploy move. It just happened. And I've always said that, like, the next record that you make is always the aftermath of the record before, the kind of reaction to that. And it's kind of, it can sometimes be quite an extreme reaction. So yeah, it was literally the calm after the storm in a way, because I spent 5 years making Furnaces, you know, with Flood. And then it got kind of buried by a major label. So, but beyond the end, you know, that was just kind of revealed itself very naturally. Yeah, a lot of people love that record. In fact, it's in Paul Weller's five records of all time.
Wow. Okay. There you go. There I know. You go. Well, I mean, it is that good. Yeah.
I'm in there with like Eddie and the Hot Rods. You know? Come on.
Well, you know, it's interesting as well that the record was therapy for you, and it's a very therapeutic record. That's the thing. That's certainly why I connected with it.
Oh yeah. Well, thank you. Oh, that's so great, and it's kind of half the reason why you do it.
Yeah. Obviously, now we're going to talk about El Magnifico next. So you've come back around now to singing and songs. I mean, it sounds like you were just taking a bit of a hiatus from that, but I guess at some time it was going to come back around. So what was the genesis of this record?
After I'd done Beyond the End, just before it came out, actually, in 2018, I went on tour with the Afghan Whigs around America and sort of was still kind of playing songs from Furnaces. And then I came back and my mate Rich, he's bass player of a band called The Feeling. He's married to Sophie Ellis-Bexter, who I've worked with. And they were kind of staying around one night and Rich and I had a very drunken evening in the Wolf Cabin. And I was playing him some kind of leftover songs from Furnaces and they're quite kind of dark and heavy. And I was like, I don't really know what to do with them because they're not really for me anymore. I'm kind of, I've done that. And then we were like, let's form a band.
Right.
And we were like, we need a drummer. And then basically one of my best friends is Cass Brown, who was in the Census Things and he was played with Gorillaz and Penguin Cafe Orchestra. So we kind of like called Cass up and said, do you fancy getting together? And we just kind of started playing in the Wolf, just jamming and just playing together, just mucking around. And it was immediate. It was just, there was something that we all had that just clicked. It was insane. I've never had it. And we just suddenly wrote like 30 songs in like 2 weeks. And then we're now making our second record. But it's great because, you know, we get to kind of wear our sort of early influences on our sleeves, you know, in a very brazen way, you know. So all the things that we loved in the 90s, like Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins and stuff like that, along with Echo and the Bunnymen and the Birthday Party and you know, the Cramps and Stooges and all that kind of stuff. We get to just throw that into the melting pot and have fun. And then, so as a result of that, it kickstarted me back into writing lyrics. Yeah, so I have them to thank for getting me to write actual songs again.
I guess there's nothing like, you know, a bit of collaboration just to get the juices flowing again and bring that energy back.
It's so important. Collaboration is like, it's vital, I think. And it's also, you know, whenever I've written for other people, and if I'm writing with someone who's kind of quite new on the scene and they're a lot younger than me, I still always have a huge amount to learn from them. One of my things that I always say is I quote Adam Ant whenever we're in the room. Ridicule is nothing to be scared of, because it's quite vulnerable and you're a bit nervous when you're writing with someone you don't know. And when you're trying to come up with lines or lyrics, you know, you might say something that's so stupid, you're a bit scared that if you say it, they might think, what? You know, you're useless, or, you know, you're an idiot. But you have to say it, because, I don't know, like whatever comes into your head, you have to be able to expose it and reveal it to whoever you're collaborating with. And so with Rich and Cass, when we're in the studio, it's kind of, that just isn't a problem at all. We're just, the more stupid and outlandish the idea, the better.
Well, also, dare I say it, this record, which I love, by the way, so I spent a really nice evening last night just listening to it end to end. You don't do that very much.
There's that argument that's been said by that I've heard from, I don't know, people on social media that then also like A&R men, managers, and so many people kind of saying, oh, you know, the art of the album is dead, like listening to the album. But I mean, kind of, well, what about vinyl? You know, so vinyl has come back with quite a force. And what I love about vinyl is that you put the record on and it forces you to listen to, you know, you don't skip it. You don't go to the record player and constantly like move the needle, you know, you just put it on and listen to it. And then it makes you get up and put on the other side. And so I do believe that the art of listening to an album all the way through is not lost, you know.
No, I totally agree. And it's needed more than ever, right? So there's always a counterculture. And I think that's why I think young people are getting into albums as well. Although, you know, bless them, I doubt that they're putting it on and sitting on the sofa and doing nothing else. And that's hard to do. It is hard to do. But it's a real pleasure to do that. And it does work, I have to say, the sum of its parts. It's sort of a very cohesive piece of work. It feels like one of those albums that is going to pay back for repeated listens. But I worry that nobody does that. That's the thing, right?
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, that's the thing. There'll be like a hardcore collective of people who do listen to the record all the way through. You know, that's fine. Perhaps I'm sort of downsizing my ideals too much. You know, I think actually, you know, I'm always surprised by the amount of love, you know, that the records get. But I'm not like a defeatist person, but I've got to the point now where I'm a bit more relaxed about, I don't put too much pressure on a release, you know, I'm not sort of desperate for it to be like, this is the one, you know. I used to be a bit like that. Every time I'd be like, it's the comeback record, you know. It's, I don't have that sort of perspective anymore. I'm just kind of like, yeah. So it's another collection of songs. Here we go. But yeah, the cohesion is there. And I wanted to go back to kind of the piano a lot and strings. So I wanted to go a bit more, like my sort of earlier, more baroque, ornate sort of sound. It feels like a bit of a mixture of everything that I've done. So you've got like some of that post-rock, art rock, well, no, post-rock element of monochrome to color with some of the, using the same instruments that I made to make those records, you know, in the same studio. So it's kind of going to, that influence is going to seep in there somewhere.
Yeah, it feels very full circle. Dare I say it, there's a bit more cheer in there as well.
Yeah, you know what? I think I get worried when I say, like, it was written during lockdown or it's a post-pandemic record. I get worried that I put that sort of spin on it. A lot of it was written when we were stuck indoors. So there is an escapist element. There's a really romantic escapism sort of theme running through the record. I think there's a lot of kind of like, yeah, like still really into the person that you're with, but kind of like, we can't really go out on the town, you know. Oh well, we'll just enjoy each other for now.
Yeah, I'm thinking Strange Beauty, which was, I think, who talks about singles these days, but it's a single. And I like the video as well. It's sort of a lo-fi, fun video. You do seem to be having fun.
Yeah, me and Steve Gullett were out in Cabo de Gata, which is in southern Spain near Almeria. So we got up at dawn, even before dawn, because we wanted to just get the amazing light. And there was just like one single Spanish fisherman just there with his rod, kind of like, what is this clown?
What the fuck is going on here?
What is this clown doing? And I thought when I looked it back, there's a bit of Paul Whitehouse in the tux with the champagne bottle at 3 a.m, you know?
Yeah, so you've described that and you've got an umbrella and you're just kind of mucking around.
I bought the umbrella at the car boot, and we have a car boot here in my village. I sort of took it with me to Spain. I thought, that's the only prop I'm going to have. That's it. Just me and the umbrella, kind of like a sort of beachcomber Gene Kelly.
Yeah, yeah. And the lyrics are sort of slightly out of sync with were you singing along. It's very charming.
Yeah, no, it's not like, it's total sort of guerrilla filmmaking on Steve's part. And that's kind of how we've always done it. And Steve has been my, I would like to say, co-conspirator for the last 24 years. So he's my longest sort of collaborator and one of my best friends. So we love working together, and we're always kind of thinking of what weird things we're going to do next, you know. But he usually comes up with a mad plan and doesn't think that I'm going to follow through on it. And then, like, we went to Iceland, and he said, let's go to Iceland and you dress up as a bear for drowning dreams. And I was like, that's mental. And then I thought about it. I was like, no, let's do this.
Yeah, that became a kind of enduring promo shot of yours. I still see that picture. Is it on your Spotify profile, that picture?
Yeah, I know. I probably should change it, actually. For some reason, we just seem to get into kind of... And it usually ends up with me or Steve getting into trouble or something. And I mean, like, the bear's head blowing in the wind down to a frozen river and me trying to get it. And Steve's like, no, you'll go through the ice and then that's it, you're dead. And then we had to go into town and get fishing rod to try and fish the bear's head off the river. And I just wouldn't give up. And he was like, it's gone, let the bear's head. And I was like, no, we're getting the head. We need it for the rest of the video. And then eventually Steve just like clambered down and got it, but like to his own detriment of safety, you know. It's very much this sort of Laurel and Hardy, The Odd Couple thing going on with me and Steve. And it seems to be the way. Yeah, and like when we did the Beautiful Lie cover, you know, that we sunk, I had weights in my jacket, we sunk a piano, and I had weights to sort of sink me down so we could have these red lights, made it look like I'm sort of in purgatory or something. And I would see the flash go through the window that was kind of underwater. And I think it was four flashes, and then I would get pulled up by the diver, and then the fourth flash didn't go off, so I was kind of there, and then I suddenly started getting like swallowing water into my lungs. And I was like weighed down. So I was like drowning.
Yeah, one of your recurring themes.
I know. Yeah, I seem to have this weird obsession with them. Yeah, I've got a few. There's a few different obsessions that kind of rear their ugly head.
The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand. Bowers & Wilkins make some of the world's finest audio products, from the iconic 800 series loudspeakers, trusted by Abbey Road Studios for over 40 years, to the flagship PX8 wireless headphones. This is music as the artist intended you to hear it. I want to talk about a couple of the songs that just really stood out for me. So, Into the Loving Arms of Your Enemy, I think it's one of the best songs you've ever made.
Thank you very much. That's actually weirdly Steve's favourite as well. And I don't even know where that came from. Again, another worldly thing. It just sort of materialized. And I'm actually trying to recall what the inspiration was for it. I think it may have been like a tiff or a debate of some sort.
Are you looking forward to playing that one live?
I am. Yeah, I've played it live on my own. I've never played it with a band. But yeah, it's frustrating because I really want to have a full band with this album. But I'm going to be doing a lot of shows sort of on my own, just because budget does not permit it. But yeah, I don't know where that song actually came from. It just sort of came out of nowhere.
The best way. Isn't that what Randy Newman, didn't he say that to you? That, you know, you asked him where songs come from and that was his...
Yeah, I stalked him. I followed him to the toilet rather than following him into the cubicle. Perhaps a bit oppressive. I wait for him outside, and he came out, and I kind of went, "Randy, I love you," you know. And he was kind of like, "Oh my God, who is this nutter?" You know. And then I asked him, "Yeah, what's the secret of writing, you know, a great song?" He just sort of looked at me like, "Why are you asking this question?" And then he just said, "Well, I don't know. You just sit around and wait for it to come along." I was like, "Okay."
Well, I was going to ask you if that still really was the case today, but I guess it is if you've just done it.
I mean, most of the time it will be like, I'll hear a line or I'll hear a sentence. I think you have to be, you know, when you're a songwriter, you're an observer, but you're a sponge, and you just kind of like constantly little fox ears pricking up going like, "What was that?" You know, and just if you constantly have to kind of just jot things down immediately. I think one of the things that I learned from working with Flood, actually, when I made Furnaces, was it was almost every time I had an idea or a lyric or something, if we didn't catch it first time, it was never going to be good enough the second time. It was always that, the initial gut instincts. And so I think a lot of the time when I go in the studio, I just turn the mics on, turn the recording on, and just sit down. And usually it's like the first thing that just like splurges out.
You didn't overthink this record?
No, there wasn't. I've never been a huge editor. In fact, although, you know, when I look back on some of the lyrics in earlier songs, I do kind of wish I'd spent a bit more time. But that's just kind of, you know, that's just being a bit sort of critical of my earlier work, you know, post album and stuff. But I think I just kind of sit down, and as long as I capture that first initial thing, then I'm good to go.
Yeah, it's a really great song. And The Violence of the Rose as well stood out for me. It's sort of, I got a sense of classic Elvis Costello period, really 70s.
Someone else said that. Yeah, someone else said that, which was like massive compliment. Yeah, that song itself was, I was reading a book on Francis Bacon, and there was a chapter title. I just nicked it. It was so great. And it made me also think of like Lou Reed's Vicious. We're like, "Vicious, you hit me with a flower," you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just wanted to put some kind of ridiculous imagery in there. It took me ages though, because like I had different lyrics in some bits that were kind of like, yeah, they're okay, but they just weren't good enough. So there's this last line that took me so long to get, which was the tattooed Russian line, and then the mandolin. And I was like, I got to find the right sentiment, but also the right rhyme. You know.
So how long did you work on that line? Just
6 months.
Okay.
It took me six. I kid you not. It took me, and I kept, I sort of would put it aside and then come back to it. And I was just like, oh, you know, I got it. And then it's that amazing feeling when you suddenly like get it. And it's like, oh, thank you. Thank God. You know.
Amazing. I mean, you talked about your understanding your strengths and weaknesses better as a songwriter when you've been, you know, in the game for a couple of decades. I guess that is bound to happen. But did you learn anything about those on this record, and what are they? I mean, how would you sum up your strengths and weaknesses right now?
I think really the strength, it does come through experience. So yeah, I think ultimately, without sounding too cryptic, I think the greatest strength is knowing what your weaknesses are, in a way, and being fairly self-aware. But then there's also a fine line. You don't want to be too self-aware. There still needs to be some kind of naivety and innocence, I think, in the way that you write. You don't want to be this kind of hangdog, dog-eared kind of old veteran. It's about trying to keep it fresh in your mind. And I think for me, the greatest achievement would be writing something that you don't get bored of. You know, you can listen to it again. You can listen to it again and again. And every time you listen to it, you can go, yeah, that's pretty good. You know, I am trying to kind of just get better, but I know I'm like still not there, you know, I'm not, but then I don't think any songwriter or artist or anyone would ever want to, you know, get to the pinnacle or the peak or you know, because that's it. It's over. So it's kind of really hard to talk about. I don't really, again, you know, so try not to be too aware of it, you know.
Yeah, it's difficult to analyze. I don't know if you've ever read the book, I think it's Paul Volo, Songwriters on Songwriting.
Oh, no, I've got it.
Read the Randy Newman chapter, actually, just talking back of Randy Newman. But reading those interviews, it seems like everybody struggles with articulation to some extent. And why wouldn't they? Because this is art we're talking about, right?
So, yeah.
But it seems like the prevailing take on this is that lyrics are harder than music.
I think so. Well, it's interesting. I've written with some people who are just... I've worked with Catherine Williams, the singer, a lot. I've produced two of her records, and we've written this new record for a Swedish singer called Pete Oback. But I mean, my God, working with her is just insane. I've never met anyone who can write lyrics, and I'm talking amazing lyrics as quickly as she does. It's intimidating. And it's good because, you know, when you work with her, it kind of pushes you to be better. That's what it's all about. You know, you kind of go, oh, I got to up my game, you know.
You've reminded me of another artist that's on my list, Catherine, definitely. Need to talk to her.
Oh, you should definitely do something with her. She's just brilliant, and she's so clever and lovely.
And still making great records.
Still making great. She's very prolific as well. You know, she doesn't stop. She's constant touring and making records. And yeah, she's on the new record, right? She's on El Magnifico. She sings harmonies on Broken Keys and Serafina.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to ask you, do you have a favourite on the record? Was there a song or two that you just were like, you were just really happy with it?
Well, you know, I've always said that they're all my children. You know, I cannot choose one. But probably the title track, I would say. It's kind of about my kids and how, like, when they were younger, they sort of thought I was a god, and I did not feel, I was like, I am definitely not that. I'm more the opposite, to be honest.
Thanks for listening to The Art of Longevity. I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. Please take a moment to rate the show, leave a review on Apple Podcasts if that's where you listen, and do spread the word. Also, you can sign up via the Song Sommelier webpage for our newsletter, artwork, and much more. Back to the conversation. El Magnifico, yeah. When I was listening to that, I kind of wished I'd played it when I was in Mexico, because you mentioned the conquistadors and, you know, there's sort of, it's all of that thing going on, of course.
A quick little history lesson at the end, you know.
Yeah. And it made me think, because I was reading up on Mexican history and how it was colonized by Cortes, who was 19 years old, and 400 Spaniards just conquered the whole place eventually. Wasn't quite that straightforward, but essentially that's what happened.
Yeah, I mean, and it's kind of just indicative of what was going on throughout the centuries, throughout the world, man's kind of historical conquest of all these indigenous countries, and it's kind of still happening.
I know. That's human nature. Get one over on your fellow human being, right? Is it ever going to change?
Yeah, step on another person to get to the top, you know. But not just, I mean, that's such a lame and simple way of describing it. But I feel like since I've had kids, I think the theme and the lyrics of the songs have become a lot more self-deprecating in a way, and very much focusing on the imperfections and the flaws of what it's like to be a father and a man and a husband. That seems to have kind of creeped into the... concepts of a lot of the songs for some reason.
So has this affected those ongoing themes that we talked about in your songs?
Yeah, I think so. I think at the beginning it was kind of like, you know, this is a completely massive life change. And I started writing kind of like, it's such a like egotistical thing to say, but it was like, I'm no longer number one, you know, move aside. So there was that, and then it's kind of like, yeah, and then it just sort of gradually develops and escalates into other things. But again, you know, it sort of ties into also being protective and feeling worried about the future and kind of like being quite fearful of what the future holds and also sort of wanting to make sure that your children who you love dearly are sort of slightly protected from the big bad world. So there's an element of that. There's definitely an element of that kind of, but also you don't want to give that away too much. You want them to kind of see you as a having no fear at all and being a strong sort of, you know, not patriarch, because no one likes that word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I guess a role model at least in trying to be fearless and face up to your fears, you know.
Yeah, you find yourself though, like, telling them off and then kind of feeling like a total kind of fake, you know, because you don't really believe what you're saying. Because in the back of your mind, you're like, I was so much worse. Yeah. You know, it's definitely, yeah, it's payback time, you know. All the trials and tribulations I put my own parents through.
All right. Well, look, you mentioned earlier that you're more relaxed when you're putting a record out. And I was going to ask you about this because I listened back over the whole catalogue before these interviews, and it just sort of reminded me that all of my favourite of your albums are the ones you've done as an independent artist. Since the days of, I guess, the pressure of being signed in those first five albums, and Furnaces as well, as you mentioned. I mean, so that's an outside-in perspective, and I'm probably reading far too much into it. But where do you sit with the industry these days, the kind of industry machine? Because you're still part of it when you put a record out.
I guess I am. I'm still in it, but I just find it so toxic. I feel like it's definitely become harder for independent artists. I mean, if I was going to give advice to anyone, I would say don't sign to a major, though. Do not. You know, however, back in the day, 24 years ago, when I signed to Heavenly, I was basically on EMI, and they treated me really well, and they were like a springboard for my career. But that was a long time ago. I would say now, I don't have any advice on how to survive in this industry right now, because I don't look at TikTok, or I do believe that if something suddenly becomes a viral meme, then it is pure coincidence and luck. A lot of it's luck. A lot of it's networking. I'm terrible at networking. I'm not very good at selling myself, which makes me think, like, why am I doing this? I should just be more of a brand, you know, but I just don't know. I don't have that business head, you know. I'm not shrewd at all. And I think you now have people who are hugely successful, who could almost be like the bosses of their own, you know, the CEOs of their own companies, and they look at their stats and their figures, and they write these big hit songs, and they're extremely clever, and it's very well thought out. I just kind of like enjoy working with lots of different artists, and a lot of them don't have any labels. And I've just been working with Alberta Cross, a Swedish singer, and we wrote a song a week ago, and it's already been mixed and mastered, literally 4 days after we wrote it. He's going to put it out in 2 weeks.
Which is amazing.
I absolutely love that. I love that he's doing that, because we've reached a sort of point now where, I mean, El Magnifico was written 2.5 years ago. It took me about a year to find a label, and then it takes another sort of year for it to come out. You know, so back in the day, I guess, you know, when you would have someone like, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but you would have someone like Dylan record like a Rolling Stone, and then it would be pressed onto vinyl the next day, and then with the radio DJs the week after that, and then it would be out in the shops after that. You know, it was so quick. And I think now we sort of, as a result of the big labels, they want to sort of slowly, no, we need all this time to build the artists and development deals and things like that. And I just find it a bit weird. And
yeah, it's a very strange time. And it is interesting just to hear you talk about it, having been in the industry, as you say, for 24 years and signed to a major back in the late 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was signed to a major when I was 18. I was in a band called Snug, and we signed to Warners. We were actually Jonathan Dickens, you know, who now looks after Adele. So it was our first signing in 1996. I had a place at university to read music, and I really kind of disappointed my parents because I didn't take the place. I sold my soul to rock and roll, well, corporate rock and roll. And we were kind of like pop, punk pop. But then I started writing my own songs, and I kind of fell out of love really with the music that we were doing. And because we got dropped after 3 songs. So I had my first taste of the sort of suck them in and spit them out aspect of the industry. And then I kind of, again, went back to the countryside and just kind of lived down in Sussex with my grandmother and had a 4-track and started writing myself. and listening to Tom Waits and Sparkle Horse and the Eels and Radiohead and lots of weird like underground music and hip hop and, you know.
Well, I mean, I think Sparkle Horse and Radiohead were part of the EMI world as well, right? So they were actually label mates, weirdly.
Yes, and I ended up touring with Sparkle Horse a couple of times.
Yeah, I saw you on one of those shows, actually. I mean, they were just, he was brilliant.
He was amazing, yeah. Really sorely missed. And yeah, it's just, I need to give the new record another spin, actually, because I couldn't get my head, there's some great moments in it. I just need to, it's almost like I'm still so fixated on the first record.
Me too. I gave it a couple of tries and I thought, no, I've got to get back into this because obviously it just deserves it. Well, as you say, the industry's sort of different in so many ways and massively faster moving and competitive, but somehow it's sort of strangely the same. I'm thinking, you know, the band The Last Dinner Party at the moment, which have been thrust into the eye of the needle, you know, and you had some experience of that 24 years ago. They do seem to be a bit more savvy about it, though. You're right.
I think they're savvy. I actually really like them. I think they're great. And I love the kind of, there's like elements of Sparks and ABBA and Roxy Music in there that I think, which I love. And I really like some of their singles. And I like that they're bringing kind of, they're dressing up and they're bringing drama. And I I'm into that. I think that's great. And I just think when you get all this hoo-ha about them being an industry plant,
it's just a backlash thing. But, you know, I think that's what you get when you are put into the hype cycle. Anyway, they seem to be pretty grounded, though.
I think so, yeah. And that's the thing as well, like, with everyone coming up, you know, in their 20s. Wait, what generation? Is that Gen? What is that, Gen Z?
I think it's Gen Z, yeah.
Yeah, you know, like, I think the pitfalls of the industry are well documented these days. I mean, you can kind of just go online and kind of like read about the music industry and kind of find things out about it. Whereas before, I mean, 24 years ago, I guess we just had the internet, but I sort of didn't know what I was meant to be or what I was meant to be doing. And I think looking back, I was probably a bit of a little tyke. You know, and felt, I think I took a lot of things for granted in a way. I don't regret it or anything, but, you know, I sort of did a lot of stupid things.
Well, there was no coaching for artists back then. There was none of that advice that I feel like the inner circle of those young, successful bands now, like The Last Dinner Party, or I'm thinking of Sam Fender.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking of people like that. It feels like, although he did come close to burnout, didn't he? They've got an inner circle that are kind of protecting them. And I don't think that was there in the 90s or the 2000s.
No, I think, you know, there was also, you had labels like, was it V2? They signed about 50 bands, like in one go, and then dropped about like 40 of them, you know, within 6 months or something. I mean, I think maybe that's perhaps happening these days with things like TikTok, and our people are just going on TikTok and kind of being like, yep, sign that. So a lot of the time, the major labels, they sign a lot of different artists and see which one sticks, you know. But I mean, it's interesting to see things that buck the trend, like Ray, that singer Ray, getting nominated for 7 Brits, you know, and she'd made an album that got completely sat on by her label, like a couple of years. So it's nice to see those kind of stories happening.
Yeah, a bit of redemption in a way.
Redemption, exactly. Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think if I was going to give anyone starting out advice, I mean, I would say, like, sign to an independent record label and then maybe find a really good publishing label that can give you a bit of money so you can survive. I would do it that way, to be honest. But I'm not just saying that because I've been on majors. But I'm actually working with Integral, who are part of PS at the moment. So I've got my own label, Deathless. And they've been fantastic. They've just been so on it. And so, yeah, I kind of like, I really recommend it.
The Art of Longevity is recorded at Cube West Studios in Acton and sometimes at the Cube East Studios in London's Canary Wharf. Cube is the world's first members studio for musicians, podcasters and content creators, and it's a real sanctuary for London's independent, inspired creators. It's a real pleasure to record the show here. You've, of course, collaborated with, you mentioned Sophie Ellis-Bextor, You work with Paloma Faith as well. So you've worked with these women who have been in the spotlight at the time. How does that feel? It feels because you're still in touch with what it means to navigate pop world and all its sort of, you know, weird idiosyncrasies, but you're there as a writer and producer. Does that, I mean, has that felt good?
Yeah. I'm not very good at like following trends. And I feel like if you're going to make, if you do need to make a big pop record, I wouldn't listen to anything that's going on at the moment. You just have to kind of follow your whim. I feel like, you know, when you get someone who says, can you make this record sound like that record that's massive right now on the radio? I'd be like, no, why would I do that? Because no one's going to be playing it in 6 months. And then it will be a different sound that'll be on the radio. You know, I think you should kind of shut yourself off and experiment. And sometimes it clicks and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, I don't feel like I've got my finger on the pulse of what's meant to be. Like, I don't think anything that I do, God, I'm not selling myself very well here. But I don't feel like anything that I produce, it'd be a miracle if it got on Radio 1. You know?
Yeah, I know what you mean, because you either have to do it the way you're describing, or you enter this precision-tooled world of songwriting camps and Spotify core and, you know, right into a formula, a very, very tight formula.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we have got to the point where there's a lot of writers now as well in the industry, and there's a lot of great writers out there and really talented producers, and that's fantastic. But there's also a lot of people who, you know, you have people called top liners who come in, and it's like you bring in the big guns, you bring in the top liner, you know, the sapper comes in to defuse the bomb, you know.
And what do they do?
A lot of the time they come in with like lyrics and melodies that they've already written. And it just feels very, it kind of puts the kibosh on the creative process if you're all collaborating in the same room, because they've got something that's already kind of been formulated. Look, you know, I'm not like, I know a few, you know, and I'm not bemoaning them en masse, but I think there is this kind of aspect of cynicism that's grown within, maybe it's always been there since the Brill Building, I don't know, but there's an aspect of cynicism where I feel like, you know, when you see those songs that win at the Grammys and there's like 12 different writers, it's a bit of a sort of clusterfuck Roman orgy of writers getting in on the action, sort of shark frenzy. And it for me, it just feels like I've almost been there. Like I had a piano line that I wrote that then got taken to the guy who wrote like an Adele song, and then someone who wrote a Rihanna song, and everyone chipped in, and it was just me and one guy. We started the song. He made like he made a beat. I did a piano line. And then it went off, and then suddenly there were like 8 writers. And I was just like, oh, great. You know, I'm going to get like 2%. But it was just so weird. And I think there are some people who are kind of in the business, and it's always the way, but they're in the business for the wrong reason. They're in it to kind of make a quick buck, which is fine. I get it. But I guess I'm still stupidly idealistic and romantic, the whole holy process of writing music, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think people would be surprised to find out that you've been pairing up with Sophie Ellis-Bextor for, I think it's 3 albums, isn't it? I actually thought that Halo album was really, really good, and it was definitely more alternative than you would expect. You're not an obvious pairing, but, I mean, she's done pretty well.
She's doing very well at the moment, yeah. It's gone completely insane. And I was kind of like, that's fine. I can just be like this little turd stain on the golden coattails, like waiting in the wings, you know, the side man, you know, the hype man, you know. But if it means like it's going crazy in America. If it means that people stream the albums that we did, then great. And I think she deserves it. She's so hardworking. She's incredibly talented, and you know, we work well together because we're quite different in some respects, but I also, most of the time, I'm just trying to make her laugh. I have a dark gallows humor, but she does as well. So we kind of like, the way that we work is kind of, it's very, we're sort of opposites, but we bounce off each other really well.
Yeah, again, I think she's a bit more savvy in that way than people might realize. And, you know, it's a funny time to have TikTok and pop success when you're, you know, a mum of 4 and been making records for ages.
5.
Five. Yeah. Wow.
5 boys. Yeah. It's incredible. I mean, And they're going for it. You know, they're really going for that song. That's what you call a major second wind. Definitely.
Yeah. Now, I'm thinking of another podcast called The Second Act, actually, and just having people on who've had that luck on an early song. You know, it's like, wow. And that's because it's revived the careers of a lot of bands that, you know, you otherwise would have forgotten.
I have these daydreams of getting a call, you know, from like Jay-Z or someone like sampling one of my records, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Part of longevity is just staying on the bus. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you retired at one point. You're not going to do that again, are you?
No, I didn't know what to do. I sort of went a bit mad. That was after EMI. I was kind of like, I'm done. And that's when I started writing with other people as well. But I was kind of just scared, you know. I'd been sort of institutionalized on this massive label for 7 years. And everything was changing around that time as well. And I was going to be 30. And it was kind of like the heavenly days are over, you know.
Well, it must be very scary because you're kind of gaslighted, aren't you, for that period? And then suddenly you're just cast aside and you're on your own.
Yeah. Yeah, that was it. That was it. It was kind of, it seemed initially like slightly treacherous waters. So yeah, but then things kind of evened out. But it still feels like, you know, it still feels like a bit of a roller coaster. Doing this, I can't do anything else. I don't have any qualifications. I don't have a degree. Go to university.
You wouldn't go back to chefing?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I do love cooking. I don't think so. I think I've just got to stick it. I know for a lot of people, it's been really hard post COVID to
absolutely. I've had so many discussions on this show about even when it looks like everything's going great. Under the surface, it's like, well, you know, John Grant was on. I mean, we're opening the season with the band Real Estate, you know, New Jersey band on the 7th album. And you know, Martin from the band, he's the songwriter, was saying, like, my wife can't give up the day job. You know, it's like, it's hard.
Yeah, my wife is up in the loft right now. She makes these incredible lampshades from hand and like beautiful silk and velvet and tassels, and she makes cushions, and you know, she contributes and helps, you know, to kind of so we can survive. But it's just got harder. I mean, if I could go back in time and sort of stop Liz Truss from being prime minister for those like ill-fated 45 days, that was the one thing I would do if I could go back in time.
Okay, because I mean, one of the questions I asked is if you could get in the musical time machine and go back and change anything, tweak it, or just redo it. Is there anything?
No, I wouldn't do that. No, I'm kind of like, once it's done, and then let it go, and it's over. And I don't like going back to things and rehashing them, unless it was kind of like for a big Hollywood film.
You'd be selfless, and you'd go back and sort and get rid of Liz Truss.
Yeah, and they'd say, we want your song, but we want Dua Lipa. And then I'll do that, that's fine.
Yeah. You wouldn't turn that gig down.
Definitely not.
I mean, wouldn't turn a bona fide chart hit down, would you?
I would not. No, I mean, 22 years ago, I was much more indie than now. I was much more of a snob. And having sort of grown up listening to kind of Tom Waits and listening to Bill Hicks and things like that, the idea of, you know, using your music on an advert or commercial just seemed just so wrong. So I kind of always had that mindset. Now I'm kind of like, I don't care. You can use my music on anything. I mean, I had my limits.
Yeah, of course.
Like adult nappies and hemorrhoid cream, maybe. And the Tories. That's kind of where I draw the line.
Yeah, and Trump, right? I think Johnny Marr was trying to get a Smiths track off of the Trump rally. You never know where your music's going to turn up. I mean, it'd just be nice to hear Strange Beauty on the radio.
Yeah, it's been on the radio a little bit. So it's been on Six Music a few times. You know, Lauren Laverne and Guy Garvey. And I've got my champions out there, but it is hard. We were trying to get it on the playlist, and they were kind of, their sort of response was, we feel like it might struggle in the current climate.
Yeah, they've never said that to anyone before.
I'm like, okay, well, you know, I think it means that I'm a no good has been. That's what it means.
Well, look, you seem to be in good spirits. You've made a fantastic album, and I wish you all the best and good luck with it. What are you looking forward to about 2024 now that it is coming out soon? I know it's taken ages.
At the moment, I'm kind of getting into films a lot, doing film scores. So that's kind of something I just want to do for the foreseeable future. So I'm sort of waiting for a few projects to come through, fingers crossed. I'm actually going on tour again with the Afghan Whigs in the church in America for a month. And then I've just got a few little gigs here and there. And then just like working with like loads of different artists, doing a lot of production and trying to get the word out. You know, I'm here, you know where I am, come to the Wolf Cabin. And I'm basically put myself forward. I'm the band and the producer and the engineer and sometimes the mixer. So
yeah, because you play everything pretty much, don't you?
Yeah, so I play everything if you need me to. And so I've got like lots of different people kind of contacted me through social media and said, yeah, you know, I've always wanted to make a record. And some are kind of like, I want to make it with you. So yeah, I've got quite a lot of different people coming through the doors in the next few months. So that should be quite fun. Got a great singer called Roxanne de Bastien. She's coming. We're doing an EP quite soon. And we've been working together on this project to do with this book that she's written about her grandfather, who was a piano player, Hungarian piano player who escaped the Nazis. That's a really interesting project. And she's got all this music that he wrote. But yeah, like those kind of projects always, you know, pique my interest massively. So,
yeah, I think it's great that you've had your collaborations with the great and the good, but you can do that with up and coming artists still. And that's fantastic.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, and ultimately it's a bit of a brutal, harsh truth, but you are only as good as the artist who walks through your door. So that is it. There's no way that I want to put, I'm very aware of putting my own stamp on someone else. I'm merely a conduit. So I'm just there. I'm there to be used.
All right. Well, look, we'll make sure we put the word out. We'll definitely give Roxanne a shout out. That's great.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Yeah. When I'm not working, I just go a bit mad. I'm one of those people that I like to have like four different things that I can juggle and then I feel normal.
Yeah. I mean, does that feel like success to you?
Yeah, definitely. Just working. All I want to do is be making music every day, all the time. And, you know, I can go into the studio. I can sit. Sometimes I sit there and I'm like, I actually don't know what to do. But I will sit at the piano for like 2 hours and just tinkle, you know, and or play the drums, you know. And then eventually I'll be like, suddenly an idea will come and I'll be like, oh, I better follow this one through.
And do you give yourself space to be proud?
Yeah, I am proud. I am actually. But I'm still kind of quite dismissive. And also there's this thing when I'm waiting for an album to come out, I do find it quite hard to write new songs because I'm waiting for the record to be released. And then once it's gone like out into the world, I can kind of move on. And then literally it's happened for the last 2 decades. The album comes out. And as soon as it's out, I'm like, bam, back in the studio.
Yeah,
writing.
You've moved on. See, I mean, in a way that's understandable from a creator perspective, and also the fact that you know, as you say, you made it a couple of years ago and you know it's only just coming out, so for us it's new, for you it's not new. But at the same time, you know, it's a big project, it's an album, it's a couple of years of your life probably, and it's sort of, I find it weird that, you know, you the creator would then just quickly move on from it, but I can understand it.
No, that's the thing though, but I have been living with it for quite a few years, so then also now I'm going to be touring it, which is great. I'll never get bored of doing that, but I do have to kind of, I have actually got quite a few songs that I've written. They're just not anything substantial, you know? But I know that it will take time. Something will suddenly come, but I don't really know what yet. I think I need to get a few film scores under my belt. That's really what I want to do. But I've just been taken on by DNA, who represent composers, and they're fantastic. But even though I can write a string arrangement and I'm classically trained on the piano, they have these incredible composers who sort of went to film composition school and academies. And, you know, I just feel a little bit like an imposter, you know, or a disruptor, you know. So I'm a bit like, but I think, you know, then I look at people like who inspire me massively, like Clint Mansell and Trent Reznor and those kind of people. And I think, well, you know, they probably didn't go to those.
Well, exactly. Anyway, I'll look out for you then on a few film scores in the future. And I hope you really enjoy touring this record, because honestly, those songs, I think, are going to go down really well.
I think so, yeah. And I think if I can get a band together, you know, I think Mark Lanegan used to get like, he used to find a band and have them as his support and then use them as his band. Yeah. I was kind of like,
It's a good way to do it these days.
It is a good way to do it.
Honestly, it's happening more often for obvious reasons, right?
Yeah, I'm wondering maybe that's what I should do. But yeah, we'll see.
Okay, well, look, Ed, it's been great to have you on. Thanks a lot. And whatever you do in the future, the film scores, touring this record and your future collaborations and making another album. We wish you all the best. And thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Keith.
Cheers, Ed.
Cheers. Take care, man.
Bye.
Bye.